From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Democrats are moving forward with a budget maneuver to pass a nearly $2 trillion coronavirus relief bill without support from Republicans. A group of 10 Republican senators met with President Biden on Monday to pitch a smaller relief package. But in a call with Senate Democrats yesterday, Biden urged his party to stay focused on a more ambitious bill. Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat from Virginia, was on that call, and he joins us now. Senator, good to speak with you again.
Peter, good to talk again. Thanks.
And what did you hear from the president at this virtual lunch meeting with Democrats yesterday? What did he ask of you?
Peter, it was very simple. He said, go big and be prompt because Americans are suffering. So, you know, we talked about COVID and it was President Biden and Treasury Secretary Yellen. And that was really the message. We can't do small because the needs are too great. We can't delay because the needs are too urgent. And so now's the time to use that Senate majority to ease a lot of suffering in Americans' health and in the American economy.
So when the president says go big, does that signal to you that Democrats will be using budget reconciliation to get that bill passed without Republican support? Is that what you've essentially committed to at this point?
Not really. I would say the first half is likely using reconciliation. The second half without Republican support, we're not conceding because, as you know, budget reconciliation is a tool. It's been used to pass some of the most popular bipartisan legislation there is, like CHIP or the Earned Income Tax Credit. It's also been used for partisan purposes, like the Republican effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act. It's a tool. One thing I feel very confident about is that this bill is going to include a tremendous number of priorities that Republicans have asked for. I don't know whether the Republicans at the end of the day will do one of these things like they did under President Obama. We don't care what's in it. We're all voting against it. But I think if you will look at the substance of the bill that's going to be passed, you will see that it's a lot more like the bipartisan bills that budget reconciliation has been used for than the partisan ones.
Okay, so let's go through some of the areas where you think there might be room for change. I'm thinking, first of all, the $1,400 checks to many Americans,
yes,
because not everyone who would get a check is actually struggling right now, and Republicans want to lower that income threshold. Is that something that you're willing to do?
I think that President Biden has said he's open to that, and I am too. I think the $1,400 is necessary, but where you set the threshold, do you have that $1,400 up to some an individual making $75,000 and then start to fade out between $75,000 and $100,000, or do you do $1,400 up to $50,000 and have it start to fade for an individual, double that for a married filing jointly? I think that's very negotiable. If you do that and you save dollars, you know, you may be able to put that into more vaccines or something like that. So I think that's very much on the table.
On the issue of a $15 federal minimum wage, your colleague Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, has suggested that he wants to get rid of that in order to support this bill. Is that something that you're willing to compromise on?
I'm a strong supporter of the $15 minimum wage. Have been for a while. As you know, we haven't changed the minimum wage for a very long time. People who work full-time for minimum wage, if they've got a dependent or two, they're working full-time and they're at or below the poverty level in many of our communities. So I think we need to raise the minimum wage to that. If we use a reconciliation vehicle, we need every Democratic vote and possibly a tiebreaker from the vice president.
And you might not get Joe Manchin's vote if you support the $15 minimum wage.
One or two Democrats, if they hold out on the $15 minimum wage, it could make it hard to include that in a package that was going to be successful. But we're going to keep working on it.
Yeah. Some economists have pointed out that the amount of money the government has already spent and will spend with this bill if and when it gets passed is more than the economic losses from the pandemic. How do you justify that, the nearly $2 trillion price tag on this bill?
Well, that there's economic losses to the pandemic, but there's also health losses. You know, in the last 10 days, three friends of mine have died of COVID. My wife and I have had COVID. We are seeing death at an unprecedented scale. So the way to measure the impact to America is not just economic losses. There's also these massive healthcare losses, mental health needs of people who have suffered, who've watched family members die, who haven't been able to be with a parent or spouse as they were dying. There's going to be significant mental health needs for our first responders, like our healthcare providers. So you're going to have some significant down the road losses in the housing space. So I think the size of these packages, beginning with the CARES Act in March, is justified by the once in a 100-year nature of this pandemic and just the complete shock to America's economy, to our health and well-being.
I am sorry to hear about your friends, and it has been a very difficult time for many people, which is why I want to just ask you, I want to go back to this idea of compromise. You do have a group of 10 Republicans who are willing to work with you. You've suggested that some of the Republican priorities could make their way into this bill, but why not set reconciliation aside for right now and dedicate all your effort to striking a deal that would make good on the president's promise to find unity in these very divided and difficult times in our history?
Yeah, Peter, again, I'm going to challenge the premise that reconciliation is the opposite of bipartisanship. That's not the case. Reconciliation is a tool that was put into the Budget Control Act in 1974, and it's often been used to accomplish important bipartisan objectives. And that's why it's extremely important that President Biden meet with 10 Republicans and talk to them about their priorities. And I'm doing the same thing with my colleagues. We all are. But if at the end of the day, we put together a bill that shows we've listened to our voters, but we've also listened to our Republican colleagues and tried really hard to reflect their priorities, they can decide whether they want to vote for it or not. But I don't think using reconciliation is about partisanship. I think it's about speed. And that's why the tool was created in the first place, to enable us to do big things when the country needs it with a sense of urgency.
Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, thank you so much.
You bet, Peter. Take care.
Well, for a snapshot of the divided Republican Party, just look at what's happening today in the House of Representatives. GOP leaders are weighing the fates of two very different members of the party. One is Liz Cheney, the number three Republican in the House, who voted last month to impeach then-President Donald Trump. The other is freshman Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Trump loyalist known for spouting conspiracy theories and bigoted comments. We're joined now by NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. Hey, Claudia, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy has supported Cheney, but he's also said he has concerns about her impeachment vote. Trump allies like Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz even went to Wyoming to urge her constituents to vote her out of office. And here's another critic, Ohio Representative Jim Jordan.
When you're the conference chair and you're the person who speaks for the conference and you take a position that 96% of the conference disagreed with and you do that ahead of time, She didn't just go voter conscience on the day of the vote. She spoke ahead of time, 36 hours, put out a statement in the sharpest possible terms. That's a concern.
So, Claudia, is Liz Cheney in real danger here?
That remains to be seen. Today's GOP conference meeting later today on Capitol Hill will be a real signal there on where the party and Cheney go from here. This is all emblematic of these widening divisions we're seeing in the party right now. Former President Trump left a vacuum of power as well as an identity crisis for the GOP. A Republican strategist mentioned to me that with Trump, the populist wing of the party has swallowed up the establishment wing of the party time and time again, and we're seeing that play out in real time right now. This is the Republicans lost the House, the Senate, the White House under his administration. So the party is in the midst of this civil war, if you will, and these members who remain fierce Trump loyalists are targeting Cheney at one end, while establishment Republicans are supporting Cheney at the other.
Sure, and Cheney, the daughter of a former vice president, represents the establishment, and many of the populist side would probably be embodied by Marjorie Taylor Greene. And House Democrats, Claudia, want to strip her of her committee assignments, which would be a pretty severe rebuke. And it reminds me that House Republicans did agree a couple years ago to strip Steve King of his committee assignments after he had publicly questioned why white supremacy is offensive. And then he lost his next primary and is out of office now. So is there a parallel here?
Yes, in some ways there are. A Democratic leadership aide told me this morning that House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer told his caucus that McCarthy needs to repeat the same action he took with King, which is move Green off all of her committees. And Hoyer spoke to McCarthy this morning after that phone call with his caucus, signaling the potential for a deal here between both sides. But Hoyer said Democrats are moving forward with a resolution to remove Green from her committees. This is really rare. And even Hoyer has said this could backfire where the GOP could force their members off panels in the future. That said, Democrats are determined. Hoyer said that he spoke to McCarthy and there's clearly no alternative to holding a floor vote on this resolution to remove Green from her committee assignments. The Rules Committee will meet this afternoon to sort out how that debate will play out, and it looks like the House will vote on this resolution tomorrow.
Okay, so that's what's going on in the House. Real quick, Claudia, in the Senate, the impeachment trial starts next week, and Republicans are also going to have to decide how loyal they're going to be to the former president. So in the moments we have left, how many Republicans seem willing to convict at this point?
We saw five GOP senators break with their colleagues in a vote to say the trial is constitutional. That's a clue to what we could see in terms of the votes to convict Trump. There are some who left the door open that could join that group, but it looks like it will be a minority of Senate GOP members.
I see. Many focusing on the process and less so the substance. That's NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales.
In Myanmar, the military is prosecuting the country's civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. This development comes just 2 days after soldiers ousted the democratically elected government in a coup, plunging Myanmar into turmoil. The charges against Aung San Suu Kyi are obscure, but she could be banned from holding political office ever again. The BBC's Jonathan Head is with us now on Skype in Bangkok. And Jonathan, tell us more about this charge. Aung San Suu Kyi accused of illegally importing walkie-talkies.
Well, I mean, she's been the head of state for the last 5 years. She has a fairly significant security detail. This is in her home in the capital, Naypyidaw. It's where she lives when she's in government. It's a fairly absurd charge. Everybody in Myanmar will see this for what it is, which is a transparently cynical maneuver by the military to disqualify her from office. This is their big challenge. You've got to remember, they have been battling with this woman for more than 30 years, trying to neutralize her as a political opponent, and they failed every time. Every election Aung San Suu Kyi has contested, and remember, she contested her first election way back in 1990. She won with a massive majority, and they need to find some way, if they're going to hold an election again, and they're promising people they will eventually, of getting her out of the picture, because her popularity remains undimmed inside Myanmar. The election her party won last November was largely a result of her personal popularity.
It would seem almost laughable, wouldn't it, if it weren't so serious, these charges that she's facing. She could spend 3 years in prison if she's convicted. Have we heard from her? Do we know where she is at this point?
Neither she nor the president, who is her ally, have been heard from. And I think there's a lot of worry about just how hard line this military junta is going to be. You know, history in Myanmar has been very unhappy. The military has been both brutal, repressive, and very isolationist as well in the past. It's a different age now, of course. You know, younger Burmese have known 10 years of freedom, and they've got these days social media. You know, when I used to go into Myanmar 20 years ago, when it was firmly under military rule, there were no mobile phones at all. There were barely any phones. There was no internet. So in a different age, it might be much harder for the military to impose on a very angry country, people who mostly voted for Aung San Suu Kyi. And the military has only given itself 1 year so far of emergency rule to try and fix things so that its own party can do better in elections. And that was the grievance that started this coup. They're saying that, you know, they must have been cheating because the military's party did disastrously badly in last November's election.
Well, Jonathan, you say the military plans to do this for 1 year, but could that be a cover for something that ends up being much, much longer term?
Well, nobody's going to bet it's just 1 year when they remember what happened in 1990. The military held an election then. A much younger Aung San Suu Kyi ran, shocked them by winning, and they talked then about restoring democracy. And it took more than 20 years before Myanmar moved back to elected governments. I don't think anybody could bear to consider that they might do that again. But it's a very different era now. I think the military, for all they have a very xenophobic mindset that's often very hard for outsiders to fathom, are probably pragmatic enough to know they can't repeat what they did in the past. It's not clear whether they've got a clear game plan or not, you know, whether they really believe they can hold an election in a year. To some degree, you know, they're making it up as they go along.
You said the people of Myanmar are angry. Is there a possibility that they could apply any pressure to the military, or would that just be incredibly dangerous? I mean, what kind of power do the people of Myanmar have?
That's going to be an interesting test. People in Myanmar know very well that in the past, when people have come out on the streets, and it was only ever in moments of acute economic distress they did it, the military basically shot them down in very large numbers. This military is brutal, even by the standards of brutal militaries around the world. They will kill people, and people know it. What we're seeing at the beginning is people using social media, calling for campaigns on social media. We've seen doctors starting some kind of a boycott, not wanting to work with the military authorities. It's been a real shock, this coup. I don't think many people saw it coming, and not many people believed that the military would be so brazen after such a stunning election victory for Aung San Suu Kyi. So people have got to work out what they'll do. But in the end, you know, the military started the transition to democracy more than a decade ago because they recognized that the country was in a disastrous state under 50 years of military rule. Those same military guys have just launched this coup. They've got to figure out a way back to some kind of normal elected government. It's just not clear how they can do that while retaining their own kind of monopoly on power, which they seem to want to do.
The BBC's Jonathan Head in Bangkok. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
We know that people of color are at high risk for police violence. Data on indigenous people, though, is difficult to come by. But according to research analyzed by the Mountain West News Bureau, indigenous people in Montana are 60% more likely than white people to be killed by police. The Bureau's Savannah Marr has this story about one of those cases.
Cole Stump was a Montanan through and through. He was raised on the Rocky Boy Reservation in the north central part of the state.
He loved being a cowboy. He loved horses, so that was his go-to. If he could be around a horse, he would.
I'm on a video call with family members of the late 29-year-old father of five and citizen of the Chippewa Cree tribe.
He was always laughing, teasing.
And he'd play dress-up even with his girl. He'd wear fingernail polish and makeup.
That laughter is Tashina Duran's. In the nearly 4 months since her brother was shot and killed by the Billings police, she's been trying to piece together what happened.
I've been in contact with the county attorney's office, the Billings PD records department, the detective from Billings PD.
But those agencies say they can't share much information while the case is under investigation.
They just stonewall. They don't ever want to release anything.
Here's what we do know. Cole Stump was staying with a friend at an apartment complex in Billings in the weeks before his death. He was working under the hood of a car in the parking lot when four police officers arrived, responding to a call from one of the apartment residents reporting suspicious activity. Here's Billings Police Chief Rich St. John speaking to reporters the day after Stump's death.
And when the officers attempted to detain, question, and pat him down for weapons and put him in handcuffs for safety purposes, he refused to cooperate and comply.
It's not clear why police were detaining Stump. Chief St. John says they were able to get him face down on the ground, but there was a struggle. He said Stump pulled a semi-automatic handgun from his waistband and pointed it at the officers.
Officers disengaged and two fired multiple rounds, striking the man.
But Stump's sister, Tashina Duran, isn't convinced.
My brother's not a very big guy. How were they not able to subdue him? You know, how do they not have the de-escalation techniques to stop this?
Harlan Baker, chairman of the Chippewa Cree tribe, is also skeptical, noting the killing of two other indigenous men by the Billings Police Department since 2017. He wrote a letter to the Montana Attorney General calling for an outside investigation, saying, quote, Billings police officers appear to continually inflict injury out of anger rather than the need for public safety when it comes to indigenous people. For Melanie Yazzie, that description rings true.
The purpose of this violence is to reinforce the settler order.
Yazzie is Navajo and a professor of Native American Studies at the University of New Mexico. She studies reservation border towns like Billings, and she says many of them sprung up as military and trading outposts when the United States was colonizing the West.
They were engaged in Indian wars, right? They were engaged in incredibly violent warfare against Native people.
Fast forward 150 years or so, and Yazzie says these towns are still hotbeds of resentment, hostility, and violence towards indigenous people.
We're not supposed to be off the reservation, you know, we're supposed to be like in our place. And the moment that you stop doing that, you immediately become a threat, and then you need to be policed.
I won't sit here and tell you that officers don't get frustrated dealing with people and make bad decisions.
That's Lieutenant Brandon Woolley with the Billings Police Department.
To say that they do it specifically to a racial group, I don't believe that that's occurring.
Still, the department's own data show Indigenous people are overrepresented in its arrests, use of force incidents, and officer-involved shootings. But Woolley says Native people are also more likely to be victims of crime in Billings, and that all of these things are connected.
We have to talk about this substance abuse. We have to talk about the mental health issues. We have to talk about the education rates. We have to talk about the poverty. That's the social stuff, right? When it breaks down, leads to interaction with law enforcement.
He says that social stuff is a symptom of historical trauma in tribal communities, something he says law enforcement has no control over and isn't equipped to address. It's that sentiment that's driven a movement across the U.S. to redirect funding away from police departments and into social programs. But Woolley says cutting police funding in border towns would be a mistake.
The Native American culture doesn't need less policing. They truly need more policing.
Angeline Cheek resents that statement.
With a statement like that, it's no wonder why our Indigenous people are being killed at such high rates.
Cheek is an Indigenous justice organizer with the ACLU of Montana and a citizen of the Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux tribes.
We don't need more policing. We need equitable distribution of resources and the recognition of long-standing treaty rights.
Last week, Tashina Duran led a march through Billings to honor her brother's life. Whatever happened between him and the police, she says his story shouldn't be swept under the rug.
It seems like being Native that they consider us disposable. So shooting one more, what's that, you know? No one cares. No one seems to care.
The Billings Police Department and the Yellowstone County Attorney are currently wrapping up their investigation into Stump's death. For Here and Now, I'm Savannah Marr.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
We are still in the middle of this pandemic, and right now, having science news you can trust, from variants to vaccines, is essential. NPR Shortwave has your back. About 10 minutes every weekday, listen and subscribe to Shortwave, the daily science podcast from NPR.
Pete Buttigieg is officially the new U.S. Secretary of Transportation. The Senate confirmed his nomination yesterday, making him the first openly gay man to lead a cabinet-level department. It's also a major political step for the former presidential candidate and mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Here and Now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us now. And Seth, what do we know about the new secretary's views on transportation, and what priorities do you think he'll bring to the department?
Well, he'll have more progressive views probably than the previous administration. This is not somebody, and this is unlike the previous Secretary of Transportation, Elaine Chao, who had sort of a deep background in the transportation world. But as mayor of South Bend, Indiana, he has promoted what you call smart growth initiatives, transit-oriented development, safe streets, those sorts of things. And we know that as Secretary of Transportation working under Joe Biden, a big rail advocate, that is probably going to be a priority too, because that has long been a priority of Biden's and was a part of his platform during the campaign.
What kind of role do you think he might play getting a major infrastructure bill passed?
Well, he'll be an important part of anything that does happen. We saw in the last 4 years the difficulty of getting it done. That, in fact, was a priority of President Trump's, now past President Trump's as well. He wanted to get infrastructure done. There was a lot of hope that that was an area where Democrats and Republicans could find common cause. And in the end, they didn't get most done of what a lot of people on both sides had hoped. So there will be difficulty there. But that'll be his role, is trying to figure out what horses they can trade in terms of roads and bridges and things that Republicans tend to favor. And on the Democratic side, rail, urban transit, those sorts of needs, which are being hit particularly hard during the pandemic.
Well, exactly. Speaking of that, it really has cut down ridership on train and bus systems around the country. What do you think? What do you think might it change how the transportation department approaches that problem? Are they going to look at it as a short-term issue or a longer-term issue?
Peter, the transit systems are arguing that you have to think long-term, because right now, if you look at ridership on transit systems, you might think, is this really somewhere where we should be investing, putting more money just as fewer people are using the systems? Transit advocates say, look, you don't want to put this into what they call a death spiral, where the systems become less useful and then people stop using them because of that. There are all kinds of really draconian proposals in terms of transit budgets where, you know, you have rail systems. There's a proposal in Washington where Metro wouldn't run on the weekend. That's unlikely to happen. But as the systems become less useful, you would indeed perhaps have fewer people riding them. And then there you go, thus justifying lower investment, but creating longer term issues is what transit advocates at least say.
Yeah, I want to play this tape from Buttigieg during his Senate confirmation talking about inequality.
At their worst, misguided policies and missed opportunities in transportation can reinforce racial and economic inequality by dividing or isolating neighborhoods and undermining government's basic role of empowering Americans to thrive.
Quickly, Seth, what kind of projects would help achieve equality at the Department of Transportation under Buttigieg?
Well, buses versus rail is one thing. Investment in buses, it's less exciting, you might say, than some of the big infrastructure projects, but those are the systems that people of color tend to depend most on.
All right. Transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Starting next week, the federal government will send 1 million doses of the coronavirus vaccine to more than 6,500 U.S. pharmacies. It's part of the Biden administration's effort to expand access to the vaccine beyond hospitals and mass vaccination sites. Joining us now is Mitch Rothholtz of the American Pharmacists Association. Mitch, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
And what will this shift to pharmacies mean for the nationwide effort to get as many people vaccinated as possible?
The shift will mean that we will have increased access in communities for individuals who are wanting to get vaccinated. And the public needs to understand that this will be an incremental program. As we have increase in the vaccine supply, the number of community-based pharmacies that will be utilized will increase over time as well. So initially, the number of pharmacies, which you had mentioned, 6,500 pharmacies, will be the start of the program. But when it's fully activated, we expect to have 40,000 pharmacy locations activated and administering vaccines.
So if it'll take a while to ramp up this program and not all pharmacies are going to be getting doses right away, how should the ones that do get it strategize to make sure that the right communities, the right people are getting priority? Because right now we're seeing that if you're white and upper income, you're far more likely to get a shot.
So the use of vaccine through this pharmacy retail network will be determined by several factors. The pharmacies will, of course, be following what the state jurisdiction priorities are in the tiers, but then also with guidance from state and the federal government, looking at what populations in the selection of the 6,500 pharmacies, they were selected based upon their reach, what communities they can serve. So part of the criteria will look at communities in need and the ability of these practices to reach into those communities.
Do you think pharmacies can do it better than local governments?
You know, I wouldn't say do it better. The pharmacy strategy is an and, not an or strategy approach. So it's going to take multiple access points for us to truly provide the access level that we believe as a nation we should have, that any practice, whether it be pharmacy, physician practices, public health, who are able to vaccinate, have the ability to do that when we have enough supply. It's the collaboration, and we're a strong believer in the concept of the immunization neighborhood, which is really based upon collaboration and coordination and communication of all the stakeholders to, again, provide protection for our communities against diseases like COVID.
You make a good point. There is not yet the supply to meet the demand, and rollout has been pretty difficult in many states across the country. Do you think that pharmacies are equipped with enough staff and with enough technical training to make sure that they can get those shots out smoothly, considering some of the supply problems that we've been faced with?
We have more than 400,000 pharmacists, student pharmacists, and pharmacy technicians who have been trained in immunizations. They've been administering vaccines for over a quarter of a century and are trained to provide vaccine services across the lifespan. So they already know the processes. You just look at a flu season, millions of doses have been administered by pharmacy. And so the processes are in place for the delivery of vaccines. In terms of the vaccines that will be given to the pharmacies to administer through this federal program, it will be the Moderna vaccine, which has an easier storage and handling process than the Pfizer vaccine. And so we're able to handle that. The thing we want to make sure is if we tell a patient, we set them up to be vaccinated, we want to follow through on that commitment, making sure that we've got reliable, consistent supply of vaccine and know what we're going to get and when we're going to get it so that we can then schedule it with patients and be able to provide the vaccines.
I think you were referring to the need to refrigerate some of these vaccines, and that is a big difference than the flu shot, for instance. Do your pharmacies have the refrigerators that they need to get this job done?
Yes. Any provider that gets access to these vaccines have to also sign a commitment of making sure they can handle it. Remember, pharmacy know the importance of appropriate storage of vaccines and pharmaceuticals, and so we don't take that lightly.
Mitch Rothholz from the American Pharmacists Association, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, a new report on that slow vaccine rollout points a finger at the Trump administration. Our partners at Stat News report that high-ranking Trump officials lobbied Congress to deny state governments additional funding, despite frantic warnings from state officials that they didn't have enough money for a mass vaccination campaign. Stat Washington correspondent Nick Florco joins us now. Nick, what did you find about the previous administration's effort to restrict vaccine money for states, and what role did the former president himself have in this?
So my reporting in Stat reveals that Trump administration officials this fall were actively meeting with lawmakers to tell them that states didn't need more money for the mass vaccination effort. About a month before the first coronavirus vaccine was being cleared by the FDA, Congress was negotiating a big coronavirus stimulus package, which was set to include some pot of money for states to prepare for the mass vaccination effort. And states had insisted during those negotiations that they actually needed roughly $8 billion. But as states were making that plea to lawmakers for more money, Trump administration officials were actively telling members of Congress that states didn't need more money. And states at that point were actually splitting just a pot of $200 million total, and that's split between 50 states and from a few large cities. We don't know if Trump personally was involved in all of this. This was mostly from the folks that were high-ranking decision makers within the health department.
I see. So there's a big gap, though, between $200 million and the $8-plus billion that the states were asking for. So why did the administration put up so much resistance? How did they argue that $200 million was sufficient?
It's a huge gap, and it sort of defies logic. So folks in the Trump administration say that they wanted to be good stewards of taxpayer dollars. So I spoke to Paul Mango, who is an HHS official who is sort of at the center of all of this. And he basically told me that states couldn't put forward a clear business plan for how they'd spend additional money. And so he wasn't going to simply write them blank checks. And I mean, I personally haven't been able to find one public health official who agreed that $200 million was enough to run this sort of mass vaccination program.
So in addition to that $200 million to the states, though, there was some additional money for local and territorial governments. The total was about $340 million. And there was a group of health officials, you report, who wrote to the U.S. Surgeon General and said that it is a, quote, very obvious fact that $340 million is not enough to vaccinate 330 million Americans. So, Nick, can you explain why that's not enough?
Sure thing. Yeah. I mean, so there's a lot that goes into these sort of mass vaccination clinics. I mean, state health departments are not big places. They need to hire people to actually put vaccines in arms. I mean, this is also the money that was going to things like preparing IT systems so we can actually track where these vaccines are going, making sure that states have that infrastructure in place so that they can deal with vaccine hesitancy so this rollout is smooth from the beginning. The money might seem to the average person like it's a good amount of money, but in reality, it gets stretched thin really quickly.
And Congress apparently agreed because it eventually did approve $4.5 billion for the vaccine rollout. So less than states had asked for, but considerably more than the $200 million they had gotten in the fall. But I mean, what was the lingering effect of that delay? And is this why we've seen states be so slow ramping up their vaccination campaigns?
There are a lot of factors that made the early vaccine rollout difficult. In fact, you brought up the fact that Congress allocated this money. That money didn't actually start flowing to states until last month. But there's other factors here, too, to be fair to the Trump administration. One is on the states. It's simply that states were concerned about rolling out the vaccine widely, going beyond the recommendations for who should get the vaccine first. The second is simply that we didn't have enough vaccine to vaccinate 300 million Americans immediately, and we won't until the summer. But it's pretty hard to argue that states being forced to ration this really small pot of money and being afraid to spend to prepare for this effort didn't have some impact on the rollout.
So last thing, Nick, I mean, in addition to the criticisms of the speed of the rollout, there's also been a lot of attention now on the inequality of the rollout, and specifically that there are racial disparities in a lot of states as far as who is getting vaccinated and who is not. So do we expect that to continue, or are we on a path to correcting that?
Well, it's very clear that this is a priority of the Biden administration. They brought up, for example, recently that states need to be tracking who is getting vaccines so we have racial data when we see who's getting the vaccine, simply so we have that so we can start figuring out where to fix this. I mean, it's clear that the Biden administration every day is talking about the need to make sure that this is an equitable rollout, so it's a top of mind for them.
Nick Florco is Washington correspondent with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Nick, thanks for your work on this.
Thanks for having me.
Soy Miguel Cardona, husband of Marissa.
President Biden's nominee for education secretary introduced himself to the country today. Miguel Cardona's parents are from Puerto Rico. He recently served as Connecticut's education commissioner. He's also been a teacher and a principal. In his confirmation hearing, he spoke about the importance of reopening schools safely.
There is no substitute for a classroom experience for our students, being in front of their teacher. There is no substitute for that. So we have to do everything we can to safely reopen schools in a manner that gets the students back into their learning environment.
Laura Meckler is a national education reporter at the Washington Post. She's been looking at the issues that Cardona will face if he's confirmed. Laura, welcome.
Hi there.
Hey, so let's start with his record on school reopening. You and others at the Post have written about his full court press to get kids back into the classroom in Connecticut. Can you explain what he did there?
Sure. It was really interesting what happened in Connecticut, really in much of the country, especially in states that are run by Democrats. Or more liberal states in general, there was really a debate. Should we go back? Should we not? Districts vacillated. A lot of districts decided to begin the year with fully remote education. But in Connecticut, the governor and Cardona working together really pushed hard on districts to open. And the result was that it was really became a debate of sort of how to reopen schools rather than whether to reopen schools.
The choice to open a school really is a local decision, though, isn't it? So what can an education secretary do to get them back in person?
Well, I mean, he used a somewhat heavy hand. He said that if any district that did not fully reopen had to justify its decision to the State Department. Now, in the case of one district, New Haven, they decided not to reopen, and they did have to come before the department and justify their decision, and Cardona said that it was fine. So they weren't really able to stop them, but by sort of setting that as the bar and saying that our expectation as a state is that you will fully reopen, and then when a state would, a community, a district would say, well, we've decided to do hybrid, which is, you know, students in school for part of the week and learning from home from part of the week, in order to reduce the numbers of kids in the building at any one time. You know, when districts that decide to opt for that, they had to explain why they were doing that. So it's not so much that the state was ordering districts what to do, but by setting those expectations where they were, it put a lot of pressure on districts to essentially reopen or to explain why they were not.
And what kind of leverage would he have at the federal level to do that?
I mean, far less, truthfully. I mean, education, as you note, is these decisions are made locally, and by coming to Washington, he's even further away from school districts than ever. That said, there are things that the federal government can do to push the needle in that direction. One of the things that the Biden administration has promised is to give some clear guidance to schools about how to do it. There's been a lot of confusion about that, just in terms of like exactly what is necessary. And we're expecting new guidance coming soon from the Department of Education and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So that's one thing. Of course, the White House is also pushing for new funding from Congress to pay for some of the expenses associated with reopening. We'll see if he gets that and how long it takes. But those are some of the levers that he can pull. And, you know, the other lever is just, you know, out there talking about it. I mean, it was interesting because we saw last summer when President Trump and then Education Secretary Betsy DeVos started pushing hard for schools to reopen. You know, Republican states responded. You know, the governors, the Republican governors in Texas and Florida mandated that all of their school districts go back full time, and they did. So now that we have Democrats in Washington essentially saying something similar, albeit maybe getting there and perhaps through a slightly different route, still having a very similar message, we'll see if that has a similar kind of influence on people who are more inclined to listen to their views.
Well, let's take a moment to reflect on the former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, because she was controversial. She was a big supporter of school choice, allowing families to use public money to pay for private or religious schools. She rolled back Obama-era guidance on affirmative action. How big of a shift do you think Cardona would be at the Biden administration's education department?
I mean, it's just going to be completely different. I mean, on most all of the touchpoint issues, the things that people really pay attention to, they just have a really different point of view. I mean, his big picture agenda beyond when we get past the issues raised by the pandemic, although this does relate to the pandemic, as he said today at his confirmation hearing, are issues of inequity in schools. And the fact that poor kids, students of color, are just not getting their needs met in the same way. I think that we're going to hear a lot from him on those issues. It's not really something we heard from Betsy DeVos. It was more from Betsy DeVos. The orientation was the public schools are failing, so therefore let's give parents choice to go to an alternative.
And just briefly, I see today that he supported the right of transgender girls to compete in girls' athletics.
He did. That was probably the most interesting thing that came out of the hearing today. Senator Rand Paul asked him about this initially and really spoke passionately about his view that transgender girls should not be allowed to compete. He referred to them as boys. And in fact, Cardona said, no, we're legally required to allow people to compete and that it's the right thing to do.
Laura Meckler at The Washington Post, thank you so much for your time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Callum Borchers. This is Here and Now.